Media Centre Science Magazine and BBSRC briefing. I'm going to hand over now to Jennifer, who's here from Science, to introduce the speakers.
Hi, good morning. I'm Jennifer Anderson. I'm representing the Journal Science in the Office of Public Programs at AAAS, which is the nonprofit international science society that publishes the Science Family Journal. It's our privilege to collaborate with the UK Biotechnology and Biological Sciences Research Council, Science Media Centre, and the University of Edinburgh on this international press briefing in London, and we thank the SMC for graciously assisting us in hosting this event. Science is pleased to be publishing a new study of foot and mouth disease, which shows that cattle afflicted with the virus are only infectious for a brief window of time, about half as long as researchers expected them to be. All materials released at this press event are embargoed by Science until 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time, or 7 p.m. British Summer Time today, the 5th of May. This paper will be published in the 6th May issue of the journal Science, and a related perspective by Dr. Medley will be published in Science Translational Medicine on the 11th of May. Our speakers today will each offer about a 5-minute summary of their primary conclusions, and then we'll open the floor to questions and answers from the media. I would first like to introduce Dr. Caroline Ash, Senior Editor of the Journal Science in our Cambridge, UK office. Mark Woolhouse, Professor of Infectious Disease Epidemiology at the University of Edinburgh. Dr. Brian Charleston at the Institute for Animal Health. And our expert panelist, Joe Brownlee, Emeritus Professor of Veterinary Pathology at the Royal Veterinary College, and Chairman of Trustees for the Institute of Animal Health. Caroline?
Thanks for coming. I'm here from our European office in Cambridge. And as Jennifer's told us, Science is published by the AAAS, who has a mission statement, which is advancing science and serving society. And this paper today that we're publishing this week amply fulfills this mission. Foot and mouth disease, as you know, is one of the world's most important infectious diseases of farmed animals and is a major economic threat in Europe. Understanding virus transmission during acute infections is key to understanding disease pathogenesis, improving control strategies, and improving models of disease transmission. Working experimentally on foot and mouth disease virus in natural hosts is difficult, but it's vital to develop our detailed understanding of the nature of the threat it poses, not least because of the potential for economic disaster. And we all remember the graphic images of the burning cars of slaughtered cattle 10 years ago. Dr. Charleston and his colleagues at the BBSRC Institute for Animal Health and at the University of Edinburgh have undertaken a series of challenging experiments to discover important details about the life cycle of foot and mouth disease infections. And moreover, these infections, these experiments will also help shed light on details of acute virus transmission in general, which may have implications for human health too. I'll now hand over to Dr. Charles Wolf and Professor Woolhouse.
I'll begin if I may. It's Mark Woolhouse from the University of Edinburgh. Thanks again everyone for coming. Thanks Caroline for providing a very nice background summary. So what I'm going to tell you in just a few minutes are three things. First, what we've learned that's new here. Secondly, why we think it's important. And thirdly, begin to tell you something about what this might mean for foot and mouth disease control in the future. Brian will elaborate quite a lot on that, and Joe, I think, will say something about it as well. So the first thing to say is the experiments that Brian and his team conducted in the high containment facilities at the Institute of Animal Health Laboratories in Pirbright are completely new. This kind of experiment's never been attempted for foot and mouth disease or any other infectious disease of any kind. This is a new class of experiments. I won't go into the technical details of what they did. It was extremely challenging logistically. It was also quite expensive. I think Joe will talk a bit about that. But they are unique experiments. And as Caroline summarised, what the results tell us is that there's this short window just a day or two, but it's there, where we can tell that a cow is infected with foot and mouth disease, but it's not yet infectious to other cows. Even under ideal conditions, doesn't transmit the virus. We can tell it's infected, but it's not infectious. Before these experiments were done, it had always been assumed by pretty much everybody in the field that detecting infection and being infectious were more or less the same thing. If you could find virus, the animal was infectious. They're not the same thing. That's not true. Now, that change in our understanding isn't just a detail. It's not purely academic interest. It's got practical implications. And what it implies, put very simply, is that if we could detect and remove animals during that window of opportunity, just a day or two, then they won't have the chance to infect any other animals. What that means is there wouldn't be any need for the preemptive culling that was an essential component of the control program that was carried out in the UK in 2001. The reason those animals were culled is because they may already have been infected by the time we knew they were at risk. What this suggests is the window where we can detect animals before that has happened. So there's no need in that case for the preemptive culling. Now, this we can do in the laboratory. The experimental results show that. We can detect infection before the animals are infectious. But it's going to be a significant challenge to do that in the field during an epidemic. That's a very different matter. It's a technical challenge, and Brian's going to talk about some of the gadgets that have been developed to meet that challenge. It's also a formidable logistic challenge for whoever's in charge of controlling an epidemic, DEFRA or any other ministry. But as a result of the work that we're reporting today, we know that such an approach could be much more effective, and I've underlined much more effective than we'd realised before. So this is definitely an avenue that we should be pursuing. So in summary, the work points the way to better control of foot and mouth disease in the future, with ultimately fewer animals culled, and at the same time the disease brought under control more quickly. So good all round. However, I do want to emphasise there's still a lot of work to be done before we reach that point in practice. But we believe the work being published in Science this week is a significant step in the right direction.
Okay, right. Okay, thank you, Mark. So just following on from that, and perhaps giving some more detail on the opportunities we have for this preclinical diagnosis. I think the first thing to say is that as a result of the, because of the results we've demonstrated in this paper, that animals are not likely to transmit before the onset of clinical signs, the first thing, the first practical consideration is that it's emphasising the importance of prompt diagnosis of clinical signs. Now, that's always been within the remit of controlling FMDV, but this paper further emphasises the need for that prompt detection of clinical signs by livestock keepers and veterinarians. But moving on from that, there is an opportunity, as Mark has said, to identify animals that are infected before they become infectious. And there are a number of samples that can be taken to do that. Within the paper, we looked at blood samples, we looked at nasal swab samples, and we looked at what essentially is a sample from the back of the throat. We've also done some preliminary work to look at virus in the air, that is in remote sampling in the rooms where the animals are housed, to show that we could detect virus in the air from those produced by those animals. So we think that airborne sampling is one of the favoured ways that we could carry out preclinical diagnosis with using a minimally invasive technique. The other option that we're exploring is whether we can detect virus in milk. That would obviously, for milking cattle, be a convenient source of sample to detect the virus. I'd just like to emphasise that, as you all know, we had an outbreak of FMDV in 2007. It was a small outbreak, confined to a restricted geographical area, and it may not be known that the herds, so the flocks of sheep and herds of cattle that were adjacent to the infected premises, were in fact monitored and sampled regularly during that process. Those blood samples were taken to the Pirbright laboratory, and using sensitive PCR tests to detect viral genome, we could determine that those animals were not showing signs of viral infection, and so there was no need to cull those animals. Now, that type of testing procedure could not be carried out on a wide-scale epidemic, but with further development of minimally invasive diagnostic tests and more sensitive assays to detect the viral genome, then that could become a reality. I've just got some examples of some of the developments that have been ongoing, and I can show you this small handheld device that is essentially is a sucks in air through I won't switch it on, but and can collect air from a room or in front of an animal that has FMDV, and we can detect virus and viral genome. You simply, after you've collected air samples, remove a cassette, and that material can be used to detect a viral genome in particular. And the other development that was actually deployed in 2007 was a Penside test. This is developed at the Institute for Animal Health. So this is similar to the pregnancy test kit format that you're all probably aware of. So a sample of fluid from an infected animal can be placed on here, and rapidly you can determine whether that sample contains FMDV or not. This assay is not sensitive enough to detect the virus in these airborne sampling devices, but I hope that gives you a flavour of how the technology is moving on, and with further investment and research, we think that these tests will become a reality. Just one other small point I'd like to make is that people may not be aware that there are programs of work both at the Institute for Animal Health and in Japanese laboratories, but mainly in the Plum Island Laboratory in the USA, to develop antiviral products that will rapidly control FMDV infection. If deployed, the publications so far have shown good efficacy in pigs, and we believe that this work that we've published, that shows that the animals are not likely to transmit before the onset of clinical signs, would encourage further investment in research to look at antiviral products that could be deployed to animals that are not clinically infected, and also use that as a way of breaking the transmission chain. Thank you.
Joe Brownlee. Yes, I think this is a very exciting piece of work. One thing I've got to do is go and change my student lectures immediately to say that when I'm telling my students that the animals are infectious for 4 to 5 days before they show clinical signs is incorrect. So well done to them. If I can just go back a little bit, and the 2001 foot and mouth outbreak was an absolute watershed for the country and for veterinary science. And some of us were involved actually in the field in Penrith and also on some of the central committees. And there were some really difficult decisions to be made. There are a number of inquiries following on from that, one of which was the Royal Society inquiry, which made a number of important recommendations. One was strengthening the evidence base for diagnosis and control. And this paper is in direct line with that. In fact, this work has really followed on that recommendation and given us much greater evidence about the importance of when to diagnose and how to diagnose. It also recommended that ensuring a competent and fit-for-purpose facility for working on disease such as foot and mouth. And then, of course, we're talking about the Institute for Animal Health. And I have to say that the BBSRC have been magnificent in their support and courageous in the redevelopment of PERBRIGHT, which possibly could be considered not fit for purpose in the future unless quite a big redevelopment had been undertaken, and that's what's happening at the moment. So you're seeing Phoenix rising from the ashes at the moment at the Institute for Animal Health, and it's going to be one of the finest facilities in the world. One of the follow-ons was also the Foresight report on infectious diseases, and there both Mark and I were intimately involved with that inquiry. And the greatest risk was considered to be the new and infectious disease, and of which the majority was zoonotic. So in fact, not only is veterinary science and the Institute for Animal Health critical for veterinary science, it has a role in zoonotic diseases. So this one health, one medicine, it's hugely important for the country. And the sort of work that Brian has been doing and his colleagues, showing something for foot and mouth, has implications across a wide range of diseases. So in fact, we're hitting that target as well. So it's an absolute critical position for the IH. And I think what this work does show also is the importance of a clinical diagnosis. And that begs a lot of questions. But the importance of clinical diagnosis is important that we have a competence in the field. And I think it's truly exciting. It was quite draconian in those days of killing so many animals. The thought now that we could actually pre-test preclinical animals and to know that they're not infectious allows us not to kill the number that was before. And many of us have had difficult times justifying and living with what happened. So this, in many ways, is exciting science, but also very important science. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll move on to questions now. So please indicate if you'd like to start with Alan Kamensky.
Alan Charlton, Guardian. Can you just explain to me what the exact timeline is between an animal being infected, when it's possible to detect it, when they're infectious, all these things, and there's a lot of numbers around 1.7 days and half a day the clinical signs appear. When does clinical signs appear? Just so that we've got the time
to start. I'll answer that one, shall I? I mean, I unfortunately have the paper in front of me, so I can give you that. But so from when these animals became infected to the onset of clinical signs was approximately 4 days. So when they became infected to when they became infectious was just over 4 days. So approximately the same time, onset of clinical signs and onset of infectiousness at about the same time, a little bit longer for the onset of infectiousness. Once they become infectious, they're infectious for approximately, or on average, 1.7 days, so that's shorter than we previously realised.
Previously it was 4 days or something.
Well, yeah, there are various estimates of between 4 and 8 days, and we've also shown that in the paper, that if you use blood samples to determine how long the animals are infectious, it predicts that they're infectious for 4 days. If you use these samples from the back of the throat to detect virus, the prediction is that they'll be infectious for 8 days. So, but actually looking at when they are infectious by real transmission events, it's slightly less than 2 days. So if you look at when you can detect virus in those animals after they're infected, so by looking at blood samples and nasal swab samples, the average is approximately 2.5 days. That after they're infected. So after an animal becomes infected, you can start to detect virus in blood and in nasal samples about approximately 2 to 3 days after they become infected. So that's obviously before they show clinical signs and before they are able to transmit the virus. If you actually look at the sample from the back of the throat, then it's in less than a day you can detect virus in that sample. And so we're saying with a blood sample we've got an approximately 24-hour window of opportunity to detect the virus before the animals become infectious. I'm not suggesting we could go sampling the back of cattle's throats on a large scale, but there may be other samples that would give us the same or even bigger window of opportunity to detect the virus.
Just as a quick follow-up, you said it's a half a day roughly before clinical signs appear when is it feasible to then detect an entire herd? And how, because these are short amounts of time, and I'm assuming these tests take some time to do.
Well, that's why we couldn't do, if there was an outbreak tomorrow, we couldn't do it tomorrow. There would need to be development of a device or a sampling method that could sample the population. So that's why we're quite encouraged by the early laboratory results on airborne sampling. We can detect small quantities of virus and even smaller quantities of viral genome in the air. And we're just starting a program to look at the dynamics of production of virus in the milk. in relation to these clinical signs and when animals will transmit. And of course, that's a very convenient sample to take from dairy herds, obviously.
Could you just remind us how many cattle were culled in that 2001 epidemic, and also how many cattle could have been saved if you had this in operation? And secondly, is it just cattle we're talking about? Because sheep were the big sort of transmitters of putting out in those days, I believe. So would it be applicable to speak to sheep as well?
Shall I take that?
Yeah, sure.
700,000 was the answer to your first question. Mm-hmm. Cattle were culled in 2001. The perception that sheep were important transmission turns out not to be correct either. They were very important for the initial spread, and they were more affected by the virus, but cattle farms are more infectious. So cattle were a very key source of infection. That's work that's been published since 2001. So preventing cattle from transmitting potentially saves not just cattle, but also sheep, pigs, and any other livestock that might be exposed to the virus from them. So this cattle is disproportionately important. In answer to the question of how many would you save, we haven't done the sums yet. What these results need to happen next, these results need to be fed into the computer models that make those sort of predictions and help us decide which is the optimal way to control disease.
I mean, would it be fair for me to say hundreds of thousands of cattle could have been saved?
I'm not going to be drawn on that, sorry. There were 700,000 were culled on that. There's a practical issue too, is to what extent you could roll out these sorts of devices that Brian showed you in a large scale in the field. The more you can do that, the more you reduce the need to cull the cattle. Only a fraction of those, a relatively small fraction, were actually culled because they were known to have the virus. So only a small fraction. So the majority of them were culled because they were at risk of having the virus, and we're trying to reduce that number.
If I could just add a small point, I maybe didn't say it earlier, but in 2007, sheep and cattle were monitored routinely in blood samples, and there were a large number of sheep remained negative on those tests, and so were not culled.
I think a small word of caution. I mean, I do pick up your point about sheep, and some of the national movement of sheep were so colossal. I mean, it's still quite great, that there was some evidence that that sheep would have carried the virus. So I think there's more research to be done there. I don't think we could just dismiss sheep as not being a vehicle for transmission.
Oh, it's no, still, sorry, no, I certainly wasn't implying that, Joe. But cattle do contribute, pro rata, they contribute a lot more.
The trouble we have with sheep, of course, is that the work that Brian and his colleagues have showing quite clearly is the importance of clinical diagnosis. With sheep, it was a real nightmare, and I can tell you from the field, going out there looking at lesions in sheep and thinking, is this really foot and mouth, or is this some other lesion? And that was a mighty difficult diagnosis. So there's still an area there for further research to be done.
Okay.
And also, there was quite a lot of control on foot paths and so on. What have we learned about that since the outbreak? Whether you can sort of carry the virus by treading soil around?
So that's a very good question. So the answer to the first question, within the laboratory, the PCR test is extremely rapid, can be performed in hours. And that's another interesting point, is that in 2001, most of the diagnosis was performed by actually growing virus, which can take a number of days. The big difference through the development of new diagnostic tests in 2007 is that most of the diagnosis was performed by PCR, by amplification of the viral genome. So that's a very rapid test, can be performed in a number of hours. And
so
that was...
That's
minutes.
Yeah.
So that was actually deployed on farms in 2007 to confirm whether those animals are positive. But I must emphasise that test is not sensitive. You have to have material from actually a vesicle from an animal, but it just shows that that we're on a timeline for the development of these types of assays. We have under development a different type of technology that doesn't detect the virus, the whole virus. It detects again the viral genome, and that's a PenSide amplification procedure. So those products are under development too. So that in theory you could, again, I don't want to say we're going to, you know, this is going to be ready tomorrow, but we can see light at the end of the tunnel that with airborne sampling systems or sampling milk, there is the potential to use that sample on farm using genome amplification techniques in a similar sort of strip format to detect the virus.
So you're going with that black hat handheld thing, hold it, just sort of
yeah.
Move it around, and then within a few minutes, it's say with your hood.
You could take the sample from there and then analyse it on a different format of test strip. So that's our hope, that with some more development and ensuring the sensitivity, that there's potential to use that as a diagnostic test.
That thing would take less than an hour.
That potentially that could be done in a few hours, yes, that's right. Or the other option we've considered is that we have airborne sampling devices held in buildings, and so they could be sampling continuously for a number of hours, and then the capture device in those analyzed for the presence of virus. So this is an active program of research at the Institute to try and develop these tests.
Okay. So
well, that's a very good point. So what we need to now is within our forward plans is that we're showing by contact that these animals are infectious. So we want to, an experiment that we could do is to contaminate the room, potentially contaminate a room or fomites with material from animals at different time points during the course of FMDV, and see whether indirectly they're producing infectious material to try and answer that question as to whether the material that they're producing would be infectious by transfer rather than direct one-to-one contact. So with this new knowledge, we can now start to devise those experiments to address the question you just asked.
I mean, in a sense, we don't make that policy. We provide the scientific information, the evidence on which policy is made.
It's one of those things that's very difficult to evaluate. Most virus will not be infectious for very long outside a cow. Just occasionally, in the right conditions, it can happen, and that's why people are concerned about it. And those risks need to be properly evaluated. It's a tricky one, though.
Could you tell me whether any particular companies are involved in developing this test, or is it all being done through the Institute of Animal Health? Are there any particular companies you're working with?
Well, we've I don't think it'd be right to name them, but we've got the commercial partner. Well, the commercial partner for the PenSide test that's currently commercially available is Sanova. We're looking at a number of options. I'm not an expert on this, but airborne sampling technology is advancing greatly for a number of reasons, even outside of the veterinary field, outside of microbiology, testing for various unpleasant substances you don't want to be passing through airports, for example, what have you. So that technology, so we're in contact with those companies to see whether that technology can be adapted for FMDV. No, not really. I think we don't have a firm partner with those.
But you do in the with the
Yeah. Now, whether they're they'll be the partner with this genome amplification technology is another matter. Something else to say? No, it's gone. Sorry. Yeah.
Sarah Trickett, Farmers Weekly. Realistically, how many years or are we away from having a test if there was to be another FMD, such as the airborne?
I mean, that's always difficult. I mean, science progresses in fits and starts, really. Sometimes things go well and sometimes you hit blocks. I mean, I couldn't give you a time. I mean, all I could say is that we're greatly encouraged by the results we've had in the laboratory so far, particularly with the amplification procedures to identify genome, so increasing the sensitivity of tests. And the good thing is that we're receiving support and funding for that work. So it's not as though funding is the issue, which can sometimes be a problem. So DEFRA are being very supportive in helping us develop those assays. Sorry, that was the point I was going to say, is that in terms of commercial partners, is that at the moment we receive sufficient funding at the moment to continue the development of those assays.
Right, from
DEFRA. Yeah.
I don't know if the nature of the question was, have we advanced from 2001? And I think what Brian was saying was the 2007 outbreak and foot and mouth outbreaks are generally much smaller than the ones we had in 2001. Is that sort of new technology was very rapid and also very informative. What this paper's not about, but previous papers from the Institute have been about the evolution of the virus, telling us exactly where the virus, which farm it went to, and the movement of it. So the new molecular testing has advanced quite considerably since that time and gives us a great deal of information. So that's exciting.
But bringing the answer back to the information that's reported in the paper in Science this week is we have known for a long time that it would be an advantage if we could detect animals preclinically before they show signs of disease. That's been clear for a long, long time. What this paper does is say, yeah, but we'd underestimated the benefits of that very substantially. This is much more important than we'd realised. And that should give fresh impetus, both to the work that's already going on, but opportunities to undertake new work along these lines, because it's going to have much greater benefits than we'd realised.
Are there any other questions?
Steve? Where are we with the vaccine?
The vaccine is probably one of the biggest sellers animal health market worldwide. It's huge, huge marketplace. The vaccine is quite remarkable in many ways, in that it, after a single inoculation, it induce protection from clinical signs within a week. There are many benefits of using it. There are issues regarding cost issues, mainly regarding how it's produced. That is from infectious virus that then has to be inactivated. And there are real issues taking out of the UK arena worldwide. There are real issues with the duration of immunity. So once again, we've got substantial programs of work to improve those parameters. And in fact, again, I must congratulate DEFRA on giving us tremendous support to develop new vaccines that are derived from non-infectious sources, so using molecular techniques. That's a program of work they started in about 2006, to use modern molecular biological techniques to produce a vaccine that's at least as effective, doesn't have problems with storage, in terms of it doesn't have to be stored in liquid nitrogen for long-term storage, is stable at room temperatures. So that's another area of work that we're quite excited about, that we'd have a potentially, again, it's scientists tend to promise you everything, but the early results suggest that potentially we could have a rapidly deployable vaccine that's stable at ambient temperatures and not produced from infectious material.
What, one of the keys to an effective vaccination program in the face of an epidemic, not in between epidemics, is this issue about speed. So as Brian's emphasised, ones that produce protection early, that you can deliver quickly on an appropriate scale. That's very, very important. This is an extremely fast-moving disease during an epidemic. And what this paper is about is ways in which we can improve getting ahead of the disease, as it's referred to. And that applies to trying to control it by vaccination, just as it would by culling.
So just to remind me, the reason we don't use vaccines is because that would affect our immune status, is that? Why don't we use vaccines?
Well, DEFRA's policy at the moment, Joe, you can probably remind me of this, but DEFRA's policy at the moment is they would consider vaccine from the very earliest stages of an outbreak, and the decision would depend on the epidemiological circumstances at the time. What I just gave you was an example of some of the issues that have been considered. Can you get the vaccine where it's needed? Can you identify where it's needed and get it there, deliver it to the animals, and get them protected quickly enough for this to be an effective option? We'd like to think in the future it could be, but again, this is still work in progress.
Why don't we just vaccinate the whole herd?
If you could find a way of vaccinating the entire national herd of cattle within a very short period of time, you know, even in just a short number of weeks, we can't do that. There are logistic limitations. How many animals you can vaccinate? How quickly?
That's a huge question.
Which one of the seven serotypes are you going to vaccinate? You can vaccinate against everything. Are you going to? And with even within those serotypes, there's a range of cross protection derived by vaccines. That is a huge area. Is matching the vaccine that's deployed in endemic areas with the virus that's circulating in that area, ensuring that vaccine will protect. This is not a single virus. This is seven serotypes and multiple variants within each of those serotypes.
And as Brian alluded to, the immunity induced by the vaccines doesn't last particularly long. Typically, what, a year or less?
Less, 6 months.
So you're having to revaccinate again against all these possible challenges on a regular basis. That's great news for the vaccine manufacturer. But it's not very good for anyone who's trying to prophylactically protect other animals.
Does anybody do that? Does any country do that?
Oh yes, endemic countries do. I mean, they have to. But we're not an endemic country.
The biggest problem is the frequency of vaccination. That's a major challenge for the control of foot and mouth disease worldwide, is to increase the duration of immunity. Some scenarios, they're vaccinating every 4 months.
Personally, I hadn't given it any thought. I don't know if Joe or Brian had.
Well, I mean, it is an issue you've got to just be aware of. And the best way of being aware is by having a field competence to pick up the disease as quickly as possible. Secondly, to have the diagnostics centrally that are quick and effective. So all the things that we're talking about now put us in a strong position for national security. So I think it's just an awareness of however the disease comes in, and often we don't know how they come in, is really how to respond quickly and effectively.
I think it is a concern, and I know colleagues in the United States are also concerned that this has major economic impact on countries that are free of the disease.
Thank you all very much for coming. I would remind you not to forget the embargo, which is 7 o'clock this evening, which is time, and also don't forget to go and vote.
I've already voted.
I'm Daniel Crescent from Nature.
Oh, hi, Mr.
Say hi.
Yeah, it's fine. Yeah. Okay, thanks. Okay.
Well done, Brian.
Yeah, I
was a bit worried. I was going to come in, but.